Good morning, sages of the mountains and waters. We're going to talk about sages in the mountains today, which is our relationship to the world. So let's plunge right into Dogen for a while, and then I'll give you something different. So the next section in the Mountains and Water Sutra deals with our human presence in the mountains and waters. So before I read from Dogen, I'm going to just note that every place in the translation where it says wise men, I'm going to say wise people, because that's what it actually says. In Japanese, it's not a gendered, it is people. Yeah. So we need a new translation. Always new. Always more translations needed. So here goes. From the distant past to the distant present, mountains have been the dwelling places of great sages. Wise people and sages have all made the mountains their own chambers. In other words, their own dwelling places, their own body and mind. And through these wise people and sages, the mountains have appeared. This word appeared could also be translated as manifested. It's genjo. It's the same genjo as genjo koan, the koan of how our life manifests in the world. Dogen is saying that mountains manifest in mutual relationship with the sages that inhabit them. And by extension, all beings manifest their lives in mutual relationship to, you know, every one of us. However, Dogen continues, many great sages and wise people, however many great sages and wise people we suppose have assembled in the mountains, ever since they entered the mountains, no one has met a single one of them. There is only the expression of the mountain way of life. Not a single trace of their having entered remains. So that's an expanded version of backcountry camping. The ethic of leave no trace, right? No footprints. In this case, the sages and wise people enter the mountain so deeply, there is no trace of ego self remaining. Like the path of geese flying through the sky, which often appears, that image, in Zen poetic reference. But here I must pause to confess that when Michael read Sutong Bo's poem to his brother, who had just won a place in the bureaucracy, I suspected that the poet was being a bit sly when he likened our lives to a flock of geese alighting on the snow and sometimes leaving a trace of their passage. And I immediately thought of goose poop. Yes, we sometimes do leave a mess behind, don't we? And the snow covers it, and the earth does eventually. Fallen empires crumble, and the jungle covers over them. But as you know, we humans have left a bigger mess over the last century than ever before. So much that we have imagined how it will appear in the archaeological record. And we have preemptively named a new era after ourselves, the Anthropocene. We don't know what that layer will look like. We'll be long gone. But maybe we can not let it get too much thicker. When we enter the mountain fully enter our lives, there's simplicity. Chopping wood, carrying water, preparing a meal, cultivating a garden, going shopping for someone who is ill, helping a child study for a test. Sometimes sitting down at the table in a big boardroom. You know, there are bodhisattvas in the bureaucracy. There are corporate bodhisattvas. But they have to be very careful. Sitting with someone who is dying. No waste left behind. Remember Dogen's words. Some of you know them well. Some may have heard them for the first time earlier this week. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the 10,000 things. When actualized by the 10,000 things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. And then there's one more line. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. How can that be? How can that be? There's that paradox of impermanence. Realization that manifests in each moment, leaving no trace, no residue of the conditioned mind, and yet this no trace continues endlessly. Manifesting in being time. Being time, that word that Dogen uses to unite that moment of manifesting in being, in time and space, which is completely dynamic and spans time and space. Dogen goes on, the crown and eyes of the mountains are completely different when we are in the world gazing off at the mountains and we are in the mountains meeting the mountains. So living in Vancouver, we can have a pretty good sense of that because we look up at those North Shore mountains, and that view is entirely different from when you're hiking in those mountains. And every year, hikers who are unprepared get in trouble and have to be rescued and sometimes lose their lives because they have not appreciated just how wild and rugged those mountains are so near the city and how quickly the weather can turn, right? How alert and careful one must be to deeply enter them. Dogen says, our concept of not flowing and our understanding of not flowing should not be the same as the dragon's understanding. Again, this is similar to what we've seen already about this different way different beings perceive mountains and waters. Not flowing is stillness, as opposed to the flowing of motion. And these are the properties of mountains and waters and all of our existence. But our perception of flowing and not flowing is naturally different from a dragon's. Keep in mind that in East Asian cultures, dragons don't live hoarding gold and treasure in a cave like European ones do. They live deep in the water in a palace. And they are revered as bringers of rain and protectors of the Dharma. And they often, if you see paintings, often on the ceilings of certain halls and temples, the dragons have a pearl, the pearl of the Dharma, in their jaws, carrying the Dharma. Humans and gods reside in their own worlds, and other beings may have their doubts. Or, then again, they may not. Therefore, without giving way to our surprise and doubt, we should study the words mountains flow with the Buddhas and ancestors. Taking up one view, there is flowing. Taking up another, there is not flowing. At one turn, there is flowing. At another, not flowing. If our study is not like this, it is not the true Dharma wheel of the Thus Come One. Thus Come One is the Buddha. The Tathagata. So this is the true Dharma wheel of the Buddha is a quote. We'll come to that. Dogen is acknowledging that we might be a little confused and doubtful about all this paradox of impermanence and stability. But he says we must overcome our surprise and doubt and learn to see with the eyes of the Buddhas and ancestors for our study to be in accord with the true Dharma wheel of the Buddha. And then he says, then he quotes an early Chinese Zen master, Yongjia, who said, if you wish to avoid the karma of Avicii hell, do not slander the true Dharma wheel of the Thus Come One. The Dharma wheel of our practice has two aspects, stillness and motion. And we slander it if we get stuck in either one. We don't have to go around saying bad things about the Dharma. We just get stuck, right? Anytime we get stuck, we slander the Dharma. We slander it if we get attached to enlightenment as something we can get and hold on to. And we slander it if we are constantly blown about by those eight worldly winds that Michael mentioned. Pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. The Avicii hell, by the way, I had to look up, is one of the many hells early Buddhism inherited from Hindu cosmology, and it's where those who lie and bear false witness go. But I don't know what hellish torment they undergo there. I didn't find that out. So that quote, don't slander the Dharma, Dogen says, these words should be engraved on the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, engraved on the interior and exterior of body and mind, engraved on emptiness and on form. They should be engraved on trees and rocks, engraved on fields and villages. So he packs a lot into that one sentence, just to emphasize how important it is not to get stuck. First, he says, those words should be engraved on our skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, inside and outside our body and mind. So that pretty much covers everything. The reference to skin, flesh, bones, and marrow comes from the story of Bodhidharma, the legendary monk who brought Zen from India to China. Zen wasn't Zen as a Buddhist sect then. It's just that he emphasized meditation, which became, once monasteries were built, it became known as the sect that emphasizes meditation, Zen. So when it came time for Bodhidharma to decide who would be his successor, he called four of his students together, and he asked them each to express their understanding of the Dharma. And I'm going to condense this. When the first one answered, he replied, you have attained my skin. And the second one replied, you have attained my flesh. And the third, you have attained my bones. And then the fourth was Hui Ke, who became the next ancestor, who didn't reply. He just stood in front of Bodhidharma and bowed three times. And Bodhidharma said, you have attained my marrow. And gave Hui Ke Dharma transmission and his robe. Now, so the conventional understanding of this, of course, is each one is one layer deeper understanding of the Dharma. But Dogen, in his inimitable way, takes it further. He says, all four students had attainment and understanding. Each one's attainment and understanding is skin, flesh, bones, and marrow leaping out of body and mind. Skin, flesh, bones, and marrow dropping away body and mind. So Dogen just will not let us get away with thinking in terms of success and failure, of higher and lower. Yeah, he's always ready to pull the rug out from under us. So the next in Dogen's list there is the word should be engraved on emptiness and form, which you've been chanting in the Heart Sutra every morning, right? Emptiness is no different from form. Form is no different from emptiness, beyond dualistic thinking. And then he says the words should be engraved on trees and rocks. And this too is a reference to a story which I learned from our old teacher Shohaku Okumura's commentary. It's a story that appears in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra about one of Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha's previous lives, when he was a young monk called Snow Mountain Boy, wandering through the Himalayas. And one day, out walking, he met a monster who was reciting the lines of a verse. All beings are impermanent. These are the beings of arising and perishing. And the boy was deeply moved by this verse, but he felt that something was somehow missing. There must be more. So he asked the monster to recite the second half of the verse. But the monster replied, "I'm too hungry. I can't recite it now." So Snow Mountain Boy said, "If you recite it for me, I will offer you my body to eat. Please recite the rest of the verse." So the monster did. Arising and perishing cease. Calm extinction is nirvana. So impermanence and calm abiding, stillness. When the boy heard the rest of the verse, he knew this was the full truth of the Dharma. Stillness and ever-changing. Simultaneous truths. Just like we say relative and absolute, light and darkness. Birth and death, difference in unity. He engraved the verse on the trees and stones around the mountain. And then he jumped off a cliff to offer his body to the monster. And in that instant, the monster turned into Indra and caught him. Indra, the god of the universe, protector of the Dharma, the Indra of Indra's net. So when we enter the mountains and waters and face the monsters, you know, you've all faced a monster or two, maybe even here. The monsters that try to convince us that we or others are good or bad or wrong or right or never or always this or that, enlightened or deluded, knowing or not knowing. We take the leap beyond, we will land in Indra's net that was there all along. And that last little phrase in Dogen's list of places where the words should be engraved is fields and villages. And this comes, again, thank you to Okumura Roshi, tells us that this is a reference to a scene from the Lotus Sutra where the Buddha sends his disciples out to share the Dharma of the Lotus Sutra through the fields and villages. The message being that the Dharma is not esoteric, it's not just for monastics, but that everyone can benefit from a deep understanding of the nature of existence. I love how these old Zen stories intermingle and how they're often in the form of dialogues, questions and answers, you know, asking a dragon or a monster or sometimes not just human beings, right? What would you ask a red cedar tree? What would it answer? Maybe you've already been having some of these conversations, perhaps mostly without words. I think many indigenous cultures, ancient and present, knew how to have such conversations, often in dreams. We have to work a little harder and use our imaginations. That's okay, because imagination taps into deeper ways of knowing. Recently, I've been enjoying an absolutely delightful book called Cascadia, Art, Ecology, Poetry. Do people know that name? Cascadia. I didn't look up to see who coined it, but Cascadia is a bioregion named after the Cascade Mountains, but really it extends the whole coastal Oregon to really Alaska bioregion, west of the Rockies, the coastal mountains and the coastal rainforests, Cascadia. So this book is a labor of love. One of the editors is a poetry mentor I just worked with recently. And it lists the plant, insect, bird, and mammal lives of our bioregion, along with a description of habitat and natural history, and then a poem and an artistic rendering for each one. And it's just, can't tell you how great this is. But just on my way here, or the last day before coming here, I was reading another similar book called The Sonoran Desert, A Literary Field Guide. And there's another one, these are popping up. There's another one for the Appalachians in the East. And Liz Bradfield, my poetry teacher, is working on one on the sort of Gulf of Maine, Bay of Fundy area. So I just think these are marvelous. I've never been to the Sonoran Desert. I've been to other desert areas that border on it, in Death Valley, parts of the Mojave Desert, and the Colorado Plateau, which is a high desert area, more temperate. Twice, very long ago, I crossed Death Valley in August. You had to do it at night. This is before there was air conditioning in cars, and you had to hang wet towels in the windows to cool the air to get across Death Valley, and it was still really hot. And I vowed that someday I'd go back in the spring to see the desert bloom. And it's been almost 20 years since Michael and I drove back from practice period at Tassajara, and we drove through Death Valley in April. And it was kind of like an ecstatic experience. It was a really good bloom year. And then as we drove north through the Red Rock Canyon lands of Utah, going as the elevation rose, the spring flowers were later and later. And then when we reached Bryce Canyon at the highest point, these incredibly kind of orange, pink, white canyon formations were covered with snow, and the evergreens still had snow. Mm. So again, I was kind of in a bliss state the whole time. But what enchanted me about those landscapes and ecosystems was their difference from here, from the lush coastal rainforest that was so familiar to me. There it was all rock and texture, color, sky, cloud, and the vegetation on a much smaller scale, but delicate, exquisite, and tough and resilient. I kind of fell in love with this new land, and I thought I could spend 3 seasons here. But I don't know about summer. Maybe I will someday. I'm bringing this up as a kind of compliment to our discussions of water and how our perspective on it varies depending on ecosystem, species, weather patterns, and how these lessons from the natural world can teach us about the nature of life, and of existence, of fullness and emptiness, heat and cold, life and death, destruction and creation. Each of the elements, earth, water, fire, and air, can destroy life and give life, right? Both within us, right? The elements within us can destroy us or nourish us, and the elements without. In earth systems and body systems, both. So what can we learn about balance, adaptation, firmness, and flexibility? indigenous peoples learned all the time from plants and animals, mountains and waters. You know, just such a wealth of knowledge without any books to read. How about that? So, one thing I learned from this book is that many desert plants actually evolved from subtropical plants, which slowly over time adapted to living with less and less water. Like botanists, you know, and archaeologists have figured this out. Probably geneticists too. Our human presence in the American Southwest is drastically, as you probably know, overtaxing the water resources of that region, to the extent that at some point mass migration may be necessary, or massive water pipelines from Canada, if we don't learn faster how to adapt and live with less water. Short-term greed so often trumps long-term wisdom in our human lives on Earth. What can we learn from the beings around us? I particularly enjoyed reading about the saguaro cactus, which I've never seen in the wild, but I hope to someday. I'm going to read you a description. This is the way the descriptions in this book are written. A long green finger, an old-fashioned telephone pole, if the pole were green, had thorns and were pleated. In cross-section, it looks like a multi-pointed star. If a human with many pleating arms were turned into a cactus, it would be the saguaro. This is what the Tohono O'odham tell us, that humans can be turned into saguaro. Perhaps metaphor is the only way to approach it. The iconic plant of the Sonoran Desert, the saguaro, is a succulent that thinks it's a tree. Growing up to 50 feet high, it can be as wide as 30 inches and feature many clusters of spines on its arms. These plants can be 2 centuries old. They can weigh many tons, that is primarily water weight. A shallow root system reaches out up to 50 feet from the plant and absorbs tremendous amounts of moisture in sudden heavy summer monsoons and longer-lived gentler winter rains. This adaptive mechanism helps the plant survive extended droughts, but leaves it vulnerable to toppling in high winds. Blossoming in April at the end of spring and into early June during the arid foresummer, a saguaro's tips will be covered with thick white flowers, many corsages for courting desert pollinators. The flowers open 2 hours past sunset and, like a good honky-tonk, stay open all night long and well into the following afternoon when they close against the heat. The fruits are red and pulpy when ripe and taste like a nutty apple jelly, splitting open to reveal black seeds. You can approximate their age. Saguaros don't grow arms until they are about 75 years old, and some 16 feet high. When they are first growing, saguaro pups, little cactuses are called pups, prefer the shade of a nurse tree, such as a mesquite. Gila woodpeckers and gilded flickers excavate holes in saguaros, and a thriving secondhand market for these cavities finds birds such as purple martins, elf owls, and finches nesting in them in subsequent years. More than one desert naturalist had seen a bobcat climb and perch on a saguaro. It is a keystone species of this biome. Nearly every other organism in its range, including humans, can be ecologically connected to it in some way. That's just background for these two poems I'm going to share with you by the poet and essayist Alison Hawthorne Deming that describe ways of encountering such a being as a saguaro. The first one is called What the Desert is Thinking. The saguaros stand up and speak as one about the heat. They tell the Gila woodpeckers to come in out of the sun. They tell a man or a woman lost without water to lie down in the column of shade they make. The saguaros all hum together like Tibetan or Gregorian monks, one green chord that people hear when they drive through Gates Pass and come to the place where they gasp. Beauty does this, though the nihilist will make a joke about the note of surprise, that it has escaped from some place in the throat where loneliness waits to be expelled. The smile from the joke will cover for the smile for togetherness with the green. That's okay. Consciousness is like the saguaro's decision to wait half a century before extending arms. Inevitable. No thought. Next poem is called Questions for a Saguaro. And there's a little epigraph from the Polish poet, Czesław Miłosz, who said, "Not that I want to be a god or a hero, just to change into a tree, grow for ages, not hurt anyone." Questions. If it takes you 100 years to grow your first arm, how long do you feel the sensation of craving something new? Did you ever feel impatient those years after someone put his shirt over your head, and even with spines cutting through denim, it took decades to grow your way out of confinement? Does it feel like greed or self-actualization when rain comes and you suck it up as fast as you can, even if you starve the mesquite that sheltered your youth? Do you ever say to yourself, mindlessly, wordlessly, "God, it's too effing hot." Or after the monsoon, "I feel so bloated." Or before, "I'm so parched." Sometimes people are thrilled to see you spread out in disarray like soldiers off duty forever in the contemplative desert. Does anything thrill you? A mountain lion scratching its backside on your spines? Growing taller than your nurse tree? Flowers erupting from your head? Your fruit packs seeds that can move what you've learned from your one-rooted spot into new places called the future. Does it feel like release or satisfaction or nothing when those time capsules plummet to the ground? What do you think the saguaros would answer? How does a saguaro chuckle? Of course, that's anthropomorphizing, you know, attributing human feelings to plants and animals. And yet, there is call and response going on all the time, mostly beneath our conscious awareness. You can practice talking to birds and animals. You can. You can do it silently or with words. I talk to crows. I squawk at them. They squawk back. I don't know what we said. Or you could do it with words and images. I do that. I do images with cats and dogs. You can send messages of goodwill and non-harming to the dogs in the park or the bears in the forest. And maybe it will reach them through chemical signals we give and receive without even knowing it. We don't know when we perceive pheromones, but we do. And there may be other ways of perceiving beyond our understanding. I'm not just being woo-woo here. I really feel that we humans have lost capacities that are our birthright, that little children may still have and show, if they're not suppressed too early. There is so much we still do not understand about mind and consciousness. that we might do better to explore and tap before we get too carried away with artificial intelligence. There's just my little comment. Dogen knew these things. He says, although we say that mountains belong to the country, actually they belong to those who love them. Mm-hmm. When the mountains love their owners, the wise and virtuous inevitably enter the mountains. And when sages and wise people live in the mountains, because the mountains belong to them, trees and rocks flourish and abound, and the birds and beasts take on a supernatural excellence. This is because the sages and wise people have covered them with their virtue. We should realize that the mountains actually take delight in wise people, actually take delight in sages. Now that may sound fanciful, the stuff of fairy tales. But Dogen's words express the reciprocal nature of our relationships in the world. Do ecosystems thrive when we respect them? You bet they do. We belong to mountains and waters as much as they belong to us. Call and response is happening all the time between our very selves, between the pond water out there and the little insects skating around on the surface, between the stars and the galaxies of the universe. What is the red cedar asking you? What's your reply? What are you asking that tiger swallowtail butterfly? What is it replying without any words at all? So thank you everyone for listening to me, for listening to us. That's our job. And now we'll have another chance to listen to the mountains and waters. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the truth.